Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Claire Clark, one of the hosts of the channel, and today I'm talking to Anne Pollock, who's a professor of global health and social medicine at King's College London. Dr. Pollock has a wonderful new book, Sickening: Anti-Black Racism and Health Disparities in the United States, which is just out from University of Minnesota Press. And I actually think, I think we met many years ago back when you were a professor at Georgia Tech. But anyway, it's great to talk to you again. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. And how delightful to think about the paths crossing yet again as we get the chance to talk about my new book.
So I wondered if you could start our interview by telling us a little bit about your career up to this point, and how did you come to be a professor of global health and social medicine?
Sure. So my undergraduate training was in medical sociology at Brandeis, and I was very interested right from the beginning of my studies in these questions about how are the kind of big questions in society also questions that operate in our very own bodies, including in terms of inequality. So really thinking through feminist theory and thinking about how the socially unjust world becomes part of our very physiology, but with a particular interest in narrative. So always interested in how we tell stories about identity and difference in the ways that we engage with disease categories as well as medical technologies. And so that was where I was in my undergraduate career. And then when I did my PhD, it was in science, technology, and society at MIT. And that was where I really became interested in heart disease as a research area. And that has really stayed with me as well. I think that it's a rich terrain that is underexplored. And my PhD became my first book project. It was called Medicating Race, Heart Disease and Durable Preoccupations with Difference. So that kind of dissertation-based book came out in 2012 from Duke University Press and looks at the ways in which the heart disease categories and ideas about racial difference in the United States had these kind of intersecting trajectories over the 20th century and into the 21st. And then through that work, I came to know a lot of anti-racist medical practitioners who were engaged in pharmaceutical research at the same time that they were engaged in social justice research. And that really made me keenly aware of the ways in which there was kind of a false choice, I felt like, in a lot of sociology and anthropology on the topics of race and medicine that was saying that we had to somehow choose whether to address problems of the medical and health impacts of racism socially or whether we should engage those medically. And when you look at organizations like the Association of Black Cardiologists, you see that there are many people who are very much engaging in both and are committed to both demanding social justice for their patients and in also treating them in the clinic. And this kind of led me on a circuitous path toward understanding post-colonial engagements with pharmaceuticals. And my second book was focused on South Africa and a small drug discovery company that was trying to find new drugs for TB, HIV, and malaria. And they kind of were working through these questions as African scientists who were engaged with international experts trying to develop these novel drugs, really engaged in questions of how does it matter who makes knowledge and where, and is there a potential to make African solutions for African problems? So that book winds up as a bit of a tragedy in the sense that the company that I followed, a company called Atemba, which is Zulu for hope, it failed. So it closed its doors. And yet there were these really compelling capacity building elements to the project that continued and continue. And so there is also a real kind of ongoing presence of hope in the book too. It's not merely tragic. And so that was my second book. And then my third book, this one is the one that has just come out this summertime and is called Sickening: Anti-Black Racism and Health Disparities in the United States. And on one level, I've been working on this book ever since graduate school. So when I was a first year PhD student, was in September 2001, and I heard the calls of the postal workers who, one of the postal workers who would die in the anthrax attacks. I heard the recording of his call on the radio. And for me, that has haunted me ever since. So as Black Lives Matter has emerged and as viral videos have become so important in mobilizing outrage against injustice and also broader movements, that recording has really stuck with me. So along the way, as I've been doing these other projects, I've also done kind of side projects of media analyses of what is going on with these moments that really illustrate the kind of crises of racism and health in the United States in the 21st century. And so although I wrote this book quite quickly, in a sense, I had a fellowship from the American Council of Learned Societies in 2019. In some ways, I've been thinking about this book for a very long time.
And it does, it struck me in reading it that it seemed like the culmination of many years of teaching. And to learn that it goes all the way back even to your coursework, that's not surprising to me, because it sort of crystallizes a lot of really complex material. Before we kind of jump into the content of the book, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about, I'm going to borrow a question from another host here on the New Books Network and ask how the pandemic has affected your work.
It's been a profound impact, absolutely. So, I mean, on the one hand, the work of an academic is rather consistent throughout. And so even as I've been teaching online instead of teaching in person and maintaining my relationships with my international networks online instead of in person, that can seem as if it might be the same thing. And yet it has really profound impacts in terms of how well I'm able to kind of stay in touch, but also the depth of the critical distance. I think that seeing, being in the United Kingdom, which has not had a perfect response either to the pandemic, but it has had a very different one from the United States in at least some key ways, it has been useful for honing that kind of critical perspective even more starkly, I guess, than when I was routinely going back and forth across the Atlantic. So after I finished my PhD, I was a I visited at Rice anthropology just for 1 year, and then I taught at Georgia Tech for 10 years. And I have deep ties to activist communities as well as scholarly communities in Atlanta. And yet being distant in space made it so that our conversations became a little bit less of an ongoing one and a little bit more of a moment of critical distance. And then, of course, for the book itself, too, that played out that way as well. So I turned in the first draft of the book manuscript in January 2020. And so it was going under peer review while the world was undergoing so much disruption in so many places. And then I was revising it in light of the reviewer reports in summer 2020. So it was very much a time that was this time out of time that felt like an amazing moment, actually, to encapsulate, you know, really think through what had happened in the 20 years before. And also, I think, you know, to really reflect on the ways in which the normal violences that I track throughout the book were becoming really obvious to many in 2020 in the ways that they hadn't before. So obviously many of us have known about these things and have been paying attention for many years, but they've raised in profile. And so that was actually a really good opportunity for me to go through the manuscript and, you know, kind of with that awareness and then build out a stronger conclusion that would be a forward-looking one that would really help think through, okay, we've looked through a bunch of cases from the first couple of decades of the 21st century. How is this relevant today and going forward? And how can we use the kind of information as well as the analytical tools to be ready to confront whatever it is that comes next?
So that's actually one of my next questions, is to ask you to elaborate on that and kind of get into it. But before we do that, could you first tell us a little bit, let's lay out some definitions for our audience here, because they might be useful. Tell us about the meanings of the title, and then tell us in particular about the word racism and why you're talking about racism rather than race.
Sure. So Sickening for me is a title that is meant to evoke a couple of different things. So one is, of course, the kind of most literal definition, perhaps, which is the things that are making us sick. So this is the ongoing phenomena that pervade our broader social world in and beyond the medical domain that contribute to differential kind of allocation socially of those things that foster life and foster flourishing, foster wellness, and those things that make it differentially likely that some people will become sick, some people will die prematurely. And so this is this kind of process of sickening. It's also, of course, in a slang sense, the idea that something is sickening if it's outrageous. And all of the stories that I kind of account for in the book are also outrageous. I do hope that the book will help people to get beyond the doom scroll element of the sickening, so that, you know, I think sometimes when we pay attention to all of the horrible things that are going on in the world, we can be left sick in a way that is not productive, but is instead paralyzing. And yet I really hope that the book provides resources for kind of going from that outrage at the injustices that are kind of going on the social media feed or that you read about elsewhere, and then putting those into a context that helps to see the contingency of those structures, opportunities, examples of things that people are doing in order to build a world otherwise. And absolutely, the focus throughout the book is on racism in particular. It definitely is not to say that other intersecting modes of inequality are not important. So gender, of course, also sexuality, age, disability, and class is particularly important in the book. And yet, I do think that it's important to focus on anti-Black racism in particular in the book, because it's just been such an important and fundamental element of the way that health inequalities have been shaped in the United States, especially as well as in other contexts. And so I provide in the book, like, you know, a lot of kind of scaffolding for people to think through how racism impacts health. And I draw on the work of Kamara Jones, who is an anti-racist physician and epidemiologist, who outlines multiple levels of racism, so including institutionalized racism. That includes things like differential access to the goods, services, and opportunities in a society by race. And these may not have an identifiable perpetrator. And they may even be just inaction, right? So just kind of institutionally not providing things that would foster health to particular groups of people. So she has institutionalized racism, and that's where a lot of my focus is. There's also personally mediated racism, which is probably what most people think of when they think of racism kind of off the bat. So prejudice and discrimination, where people have different assumptions about people's abilities and motives and intentions, and that is kind of organized by race. And so Jones, and I think this is important, also highlights that that might be intentional or unintentional. And I think that that's often really important in understanding the ways that healthcare practitioners play a role. Most healthcare practitioners do want the best for all their patients, and yet they still do play really key and problematic roles in continuing and reinforcing health disparities. And then there's also internalized racism. So this is where members of stigmatized groups internalize negative messages about abilities and intrinsic worth. And that's not so much the focus of my own book, but I do think that it's an important thing that others might go on to explore further, probably with more kind of first-person accounts than this book provides, which is mostly focused on media representations and already accessible accounts.
Well, I'm glad you talked about Jones's three levels of racism, because I was going to ask you to explain those before we moved on to the next question, but you did it for us. So thank you. So the book has six chapters, and each chapter is a case study, a kind of case study. And the case studies are all drawn from the 20th century. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that. Why do we sort of start immediately post September 11th? And then it really moves all the way up to the very, very recent events. In the conclusion, you put each of these cases sort of in conversation with events that are happening, I'm guessing, as you're revising the book in 2020.
Absolutely. So yeah, they're all events from the 21st century. And I feel like this is really important. And this absolutely is informed by my work in teaching. So I used to, at Georgia Tech, I would teach these classes in biomedicine and culture and science, technology, and race. And I found that the way that we often teach about racism and health is that we tell it chronologically. So we talk first about slavery, colonialism, and then we kind of move through up to the present day. And I think that this approach is not actually very successful in engaging students for multiple reasons. So for one thing, it starts on this macro level that young people just have a hard time getting their heads around. It's remote from their experiences. It's remote in time. And it can even foster among some students a sense of, oh, wow, I sure am glad I'm not from the past when things were bad. And mm-hmm. Now I'm just where things are better. And so, you know, so that's cool. And as if it happens almost naturally. And so I think that using cases that are all from our students' own lifetimes, although 2001 will soon age out. I'll be teaching first year students who were not yet alive in 2001 very soon. But you know, as we go through 2005 and through the rest, you know, they're all kind of within the broad living memory of our students. It is an accessible way to reach them. And all of the phenomena are just much more kind of relatable to them. Like, things that I talk about may have happened to them or to people they know, people in their broader communities. They've read about them in their ongoing lives before coming to a university classroom. And so that means that when I then go back and kind of loop back, so kind of talk about a case from the 21st century, loop back and talk about the historical kind of roots of that and some legacies that are lived through that ongoing inequality, the students are already kind of in the story, right? They're already engaged. They're already brought in. And then it just situates the story really differently. And I think it's also important for all of us, so whether we're in the classroom or otherwise, to remember that sometimes, you know, and Ruha Benjamin, for example, has really highlighted this a lot in her work about sometimes this kind of question of distrust of medicine is articulated as if it is just a legacy of a horrific past. But if we look at contemporary cases, we can see that that distrust is founded and grounded in institutions that are untrustworthy. And so what we really need to do is to, you know, really make our institutions more trustworthy and kind of put the focus there. And the ongoing reinforcement of inequality, reinvention, reentrenchment, rather than, you know, I think it can be a little bit complacent to talk about other people, other times, other places.
Sure. So I wondered if you could, what are some of the case studies? I wondered if you could give our listeners a sense of the kinds of things that the book covers.
Sure. So as you mentioned already, the first case, or I suppose I mentioned, the first case is about the deaths of the Black postal workers in the 2001 anthrax attacks. And this case is kind of an amazing one to me in the sense that a lot of people actually don't remember this event. And I think it's partly because it just happened so soon after the kind of much larger scale events of September 11th, 2001. So it happened in October, so now 20 years ago. So in this case, we have these postal workers who were exposed to anthrax that was sent through the mail directed at media institutions and at the Capitol. And this case looks at, it's really anchored in a 911 call that one of the two postal workers made, in which he actually describes his attempts to get medical care and the ways in which he's thwarted, and his attempts to get information from his governmental employers and the way that those are thwarted. And as I mentioned, it's a really haunting kind of 911 call because we listen to it already knowing the very tragic outcome. The second chapter looks at a former widely known case, which is Hurricane Katrina, but it takes a slightly unusual route in. So looking at chronic disease in particular. So as I mentioned, heart disease has long been an interest of mine. And this chapter looks at, okay, how is it that when you have a natural disaster, so archetypally in global health, you would think, okay, we would expect outbreaks of infectious disease. But here we saw that after the initial crisis of the storm, the real impact of Katrina was born in morbidity and mortality due to chronic disease, so heart disease and diabetes especially. And so I look through the ways here, especially that pharmaceutical flows were disrupted, both acutely and more long-term, in order to look at how that played out. And so the kind of broader ways in which the failure to extend full citizenship and health to the survivors of Katrina was also contributing to this chronic disease increase. The third case is about mass incarceration, and it looks at the suspended sentences of the Scott sisters. So this, again, is one that some people are aware of, others aren't. This is a case in which two sisters were serving double life sentences in a Mississippi prison for a trivial crime, and they were released on suspended sentences dependent on one sister donating her kidney to the other. Now, this chapter is really engaged with questions of bioethics and the ways in which the kind of bioethics of the event should not be separated from the bioethics of the uneventful. And that is also a really important element of the next chapter about the Flint water crisis. So this too, very widely known case, But here again, I take a small element within it. So looking at the ways in which General Motors machines were protected. So as soon as the water source was changed, the General Motors plant, the people who ran the GM plant noticed that that the new water was corroding the machinery and successfully lobbied for a return to the previous water source before the damage was permanent. Whereas people also noticed problems with the water and faced a much harder road to get that addressed. And so how is it that machines are ahead in the line for safe water ahead of people? And then the fifth chapter looks at police brutality and enforcing segregation at a pool party. So this one takes on the case that was a viral video as well of the Jajeria Becton case in McKinney, Texas. And many people may remember it. So this was when there was a young girl in a bikini who was pinned down by a police officer in full uniform. And it really rendered really stark the ways in which police brutality is a tool that reinforces residential segregation in ways that both cause harm of the police brutality itself, but also create situations in which our very communities are stressful situations for many and are also places in which not everyone has access to leisure and to flourishing. And then the last substantive chapter is about Serena Williams' birth story. So this is when Serena Williams was giving birth. She had life-threatening complications. And even she, as a kind of global superstar and real expert in her body, had a difficult time getting taken seriously and getting listened to when she was facing these life-threatening complications. And so she herself has articulated this in reproductive justice terms as being something that really illustrates the challenges that Black women in the U.S. face in getting adequate care. And then, as you've mentioned, the conclusion works through all of the chapters in light of the pandemic. And so looking at the ways in which things like failure to protect essential workers and the real inequalities of living in segregated neighborhoods with differential access to resources and many, many other elements, right? And of course, police brutality being so prominent in summer 2020 as well. The way that all of these kind of elements that have come together in the book were also happening in 2020 and are ongoing.
And so you talk about the case studies all about health, not necessarily medicine in the way that it's narrowly defined. Could you say a little bit about what is, you're an STS scholar, science and technology studies scholar. What is that? Some of our listeners might not know. And then why do you explain the approach that you use to looking at these different case studies as being predominantly humanistic?
Yeah, so science, technology, and society, or science and technology studies, is an interdisciplinary field that broadly looks at how science and technology shape society and how society shapes science and technology. And in this book, the science and technology is mostly pretty low tech, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yes, there are medical technologies, so including Cipro that was not provided to the postal workers and other pharmaceuticals that are not provided after Hurricane Katrina. So these are medical technologies, but there's also many other technologies ranging from traditional media to social media. Swimming pools are very kind of urban infrastructures. So these are all technologies as well. And science is not only what is made in labs, the kind of knowledge that is made in labs, but also how we come to know the world, right? So these kinds of really much broader epistemological questions. And one of the things that is common in STS is to really look at the emergent processes of knowledge and of science and technology. So not kind of saying, Because this was known in science, or because this technology existed, therefore this social thing happened, but to look at the ways that those are co-constructed. So how we know the world and the world as it is are constantly changing in relationship to each other. And I think this is also an important thing with Sickening as a title. I mean, all my titles actually are present progressives. So my first book is Medicating Race. My second book is Synthesizing Hope. And then this one is Sickening, and really attentive to the ways in which the kind of social world is constantly being created through both material processes and semiotic processes. So, you know, if you think about kind of classic STS thinkers who are also widely look to in other fields. So like Donna Haraway, for example, really interested in material semiotic questions. That is kind of where this is coming from. It is, though, conventional in STS. Most STS is broadly social science in the sense that it does qualitative research. So, and I have myself done a lot of qualitative research. So engaging ethnographically with a lab or with a medical context, for example, would be quite conventional. Quantitative approaches are also sometimes used, less so in STS, but very important in the literature of health disparities. But this book is predominantly interpretive in its method. So I don't do any novel interviews. I don't go to any novel archives even. I just, you know, the information is kind of out there. And I think my goal with this book is just to encourage folks to sit a little bit longer with the stories, to dig a little bit deeper into them, rather than kind of do a more traditional, maybe, anthropology or STS approach of doing interviews and, you know, or maybe focus groups or, you know, some other kind of approach that might get to generating novel qualitative data. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. I mean, I think one is that, you know, as a teacher, I often have students who want to have, you know, who want to write their stories. They want to write their own studies about suffering. And yet the way that they want to do that is to talk to suffering people and say, please tell me the story of your suffering. Now, sometimes mm-hmm. that is really important. That's an important part of witnessing. And often that can uncover stories that are not widely known. But I think it often is the case that the students that I'm working with want to tell a story that's already been told, and that they're asking suffering people to tell that story, not for the benefit of suffering people, but for the benefit of the researcher. And Nassim Parvin has really explored this beautifully in the ways that these stories get commodified in the academic infrastructure. And so I specifically forswear that in this particular book. Doesn't mean I won't do qualitative research in the future, but but I think that it felt important to do this as just an interpretive approach, and very much humanistic. So funded by the ACLS, American Council of Learned Societies. So really in that kind of vein.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Well, I'd love to talk a little bit about the style of these chapters. I have actually used the article that appeared in Science, Technology, and Human Values about the Scott sisters that you wrote. And I've used that article as the basis for writing up a fairly traditional bioethics case study to discuss in a fairly traditional format. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how the article And the way, you know, that article might get repackaged in, say, a case study where you want to engage students in talking about the various bioethical principles, how that looks different from the way that you've presented this case in Sickening.
Yeah, so that's the only case that I've actually previously published. And I think the way that it's different is pretty revealing, actually, to the writing approach of the book itself. So the in the book, I really try to lead with the story in order to be as accessible as possible to students and also to general readers, and to really put the kind of theoretical debates toward the end. And so, I mean, I am committed to the theoretical debates. I'm very interested in these questions of biological citizenship and how do we understand how biological citizenship operates and how can we understand bioethics that has been so focused on individual level questions as being relevant to broader social questions. And I do care deeply about that. But I put all of those things throughout the book and each chapter, I put them toward the end of the chapter. As teachers, we know that's where the more motivated students will get all the way to the end, the more motivated mm-hmm. students will kind of get there. And yet we won't alienate the rest of the students by kind of leading with that. Because like there are 0% of undergraduate students who go into a class saying, you know, the reason I'm taking this class is because I really want to understand how biological citizenship operates in, you know, like that's not where they're coming from. Right. So that's why I've kind of structured each chapter in that way, really leading with an accessible narrative that's meant to draw those students in, building out to broader structural issues, and putting the kind of more erudite theory, keeping it light, and really I do try to explain it. So, you know, your motivated upper-level undergraduates can absolutely get it. Or, you know, college-educated readers who are, or even less, if they're very knowledgeable about this information, less educated readers than that. I try to put, you know, those things at the end of the chapter, so that they don't get too bogged down.
This is a book that struck me as a kind of, and so I don't usually ask, how do you imagine your book being used? That's not normally a question that I ask because, you know, most authors just want to see it read. But this book to me just really asks the reader, how are you going to use this, it seems. And so I was really thinking a lot as I was reading about how could each of these chapters and cases be used in an undergraduate classroom, in a graduate classroom, in our correspondence. Before this interview, you talked about sort of imagining the book as being useful in activist circles. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you see the book being picked up.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely wanted to think about that unusually, right? So unlike my first two books, which I was following very much that practice that you talk about mm-hmm. of, okay, I wanted to get out. I needed tenure. I needed to kind of set my agenda as an intellectual with my first book. My second book is a very, empirically driven kind of case that is not going to be of very wide interest, right? I mean, not that many people are deeply interested in questions of pharmaceutical science at that level of detail. Whereas this one, I feel like because the questions are of broader interest, and because I really do want it to be useful in the classroom, I thought right from the beginning about, okay, how can it be used? How can it be used in diverse ways? And so one thing that I do is to really try to, I think that it can be used either as a whole or in parts. So I imagine that many people will use just one chapter if they're teaching about something else. So in a chapter that is about, in a class that is about environmental racism or about environmental justice more broadly, you know, they might just use just the Flint water crisis chapter, mm-hmm. right? Or similarly, I could imagine a chapter, class that is about mass incarceration and the broader impacts of mass incarceration, or maybe an abolitionist class that might use just the chapter about the Scott sisters. a chapter on social media that might just use the police brutality case. So, you know, that I've tried to make them so that they are quite accessible on their own as it is. But I also hope that it will be picked up in classes and read as a whole as well. So in an undergraduate context, that would mean, you know, a little bit at a time. The chapters aren't too long. So, you know, they can be used in an undergraduate classroom. I just can't stand it when I have a book that I love and the chapters are just too long for me to be able to assign to the students and share them, right? So I, you know, they're short enough that you can use them in an undergraduate classroom, kind of depending on the level, either one chapter at a time or two at a time. And then students can then layer the knowledge, right? So looking at, okay, how do things within medical care happen? How about occupational elements? How about residential segregation? How about, you know, these kind of diverse phenomena? How do they come together? Also attentive to resistances, also attentive to some kind of historical legacies and theoretical contours kind of throughout. And I think that that'll pay off for students. And for a graduate class, I would imagine that they would be all read at once, right? So it's a pretty short book, so just about 70,000 words. And so, you know, they could, it would be kind of a treat for them. It could be a book that is toward the end of the term when folks are getting a bit tired and wanting something maybe a little bit more accessible. They can read the 145 pages and really think through, okay, you know, okay, how do all of these different elements come together? And I could imagine it being in a class that was in STS or on health inequalities, or, you know, there's kind of diverse classes. I would also note that there are, I would think that it would also be useful for medical students too, or for other health students. So, you know, which we don't kind of always think about in terms of, in some ways, they're a lot more like undergraduates than like postgraduates, even though, you know, they're kind of postgraduate age and it is postgraduate. But in professional schools, right, as a way, I think sometimes the gap between the way that they're taught medical ethics, for example, and their day-to-day kind of work in medicine is so great. And so I think that, you know, I'm trying to make it be, again, a bit of a link similar to the way that it is for the undergrads, of grounding it in concrete experience and familiar stories, and then going, you know, kind of big and structural. And then I hope that, I mean, I did actually have several colleagues read the book in draft. So when I I sent it off for peer review, and then at the same time, I had friends and colleagues teaching with the text, and that was really helpful, actually, in having an opportunity to kind of rehone in light of what they said and the feedback that their students had. And so I really appreciate that. I guess especially Natalie Valdez at Wellesley. At Wellesley, she taught it and then had me visit. And it was right when the students had gone home for lockdown. And so I was talking to them that first week. And it was really a useful opportunity to talk through it. And they read the whole manuscript, I mean, so as upper level undergraduate students at Wellesley, and found it useful and accessible. And yet their conversation also helped me to think through how to hone it.
That's wonderful. So these are tested teaching materials and classes other than yours. That's wonderful. I've got just a couple more questions before we get to our traditional final question. The next one is, one thing that struck me about the book was the way that you wove media into each of the chapters. And it seemed to me that in thinking about teaching the book, that each of these cases would be cases that could, almost should, be paired with video clips, audio clips, that there are some kind of primary source material that you're asking students to get into. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the kinds of texts that you might assign along with each of the cases.
Yeah, so I think there's more than one answer to that. I mean, so on one level, there are really classic video compilations. So there's a series, Unnatural Causes, which was made by PBS several years ago now. My favorite episode of it is called When the Bow Breaks, and it has this, it's a really kind of compelling 20-something minute, so it works well in the classroom, video that explains why it is that class alone doesn't explain the disparities in maternal and infant morbidity and mortality in the United States. And so, you know, so those are really great resources, and there's lots of those. But at the same time, I mean, I think that it's also important to be nimble and always be incorporating new media. And I have often encouraged students to bring things in as well. So a kind of go-to assignment that I often used at Georgia Tech, for example, was that each day in class, students would have to, particular students would be kind of designated for that day to bring in media clips that that they say pertain to the reading. And so they would have to, you know, explain, what did the reading say? How is this media clip that they brought in relevant to that? And then that would foster kind of a broader discussion. And so, you know, kind of that's part of kind of waking students up to the ways in which their media saturated environments are, you know, amenable to the same analytical tools that they're often using in our classrooms. And I guess the other thing I would say to that is that I think that there's a lot of great work going on in media analysis that could well be paired with this too. So, I mean, Ruha Benjamin being one that I've mentioned already, but her book, Race After Technology, I think is, you know, really usefully looking at some of the same issues in quite a different set of domains. And so even though she also shares in much of her work an interest in health, that I have, and we've known each other for many years, and comment as she provided, you may have noticed she blurbed the book and, you know, we comment in each other's manuscripts and so on. And yet the questions of algorithmic inequalities that she's highlighting are, you know, kind of a different and complementary set. And so I think that if you would look at those kinds of things together, then the students really get a deeper analysis.
So this does bring us right up to my final question, which is the book kind of culminates in the conclusion with an assignment that you use that you call the sickening assignment. And I wondered if you could describe that for our listeners.
Yeah, sure. So this is a variation of an assignment that I've myself taken in class with Joe Dumit, who was one of my advisors of my PhD, who himself is a student of Donna Haraway. And so this is kind of a version of her assignment. And, you know, so these are all, you know, kind of iterations of each other. And then I've modified it along the way to suit kind of my purposes. So basically the way the sickening assignment works is it's just a template for analysis for students. And so it asks them to start out by mapping the terrain that they're looking at of a particular case, so kind of defining the case by finding a micro scale. And so often that's the place where it starts, right? So that would be something like the General Motors plant getting the clean water when the people didn't, or the 911 call of the postal worker. So that's a micro scale. But then thinking about, okay, what is the meso scale in which that is happening? So what is the neighborhood or the city or the region? How does that matter? Who's around as a participant or a bystander? And then also a macro scale. So how is this about kind of a moment in US history? How is it situated in broader phenomena of racialized inequality? So you kind of start out by kind of creating this micro, meso, macro model, and then informing the account by reading. So reading media closely, also reading materials from activist organizations, and reading relevant scholarship. And so part of that reading of relevant scholarship, I'll come back to in a second, about making sure that you also read work by Black scholars in particular, that is included within the domain that you define as relevant scholarship. And then the next step is to enrich the analytical frame by adding layers of analysis. So this is kind of a checklist for people, but it's just a spur, to kind of think about additional elements that don't jump to mind right away. So paying attention to history, to infrastructure, technology, economic context, citizenship claims, intersections, voice, knowledge, and power. And so by kind of working through those, it helps to illuminate extra levels at which things are happening. And then, of course, writing the account. So, and there's a few caveats within there. So one is to remember the humanity. So I think sometimes there's a problem with this current contemporary landscape of outrage where the people whose stories are being told kind of get paved over for the purpose of a really scathing point. And even though the system is brutal, I think it's really important that our treatment of the subjects that are, you know, we're discussing in the system are not themselves also brutal. And then at the same time, though, remember social justice, because I think sometimes people get so into the minutiae of the stories that they forget to, you know, really remember that the point here is to call the systems into account. So not just to, and I think this is a big problem with a lot of STS work, not just to kind of get mired in the, oh, how fascinating it is, how complicated the system is, but really to remember then to, okay, then come up for air and say, okay, here is the social justice demand. And then as the students are writing, to be sure to cite Black women. So this is a hashtag and it's also a movement. And I think that, I think too rarely do we talk to our students at an undergraduate level about citational politics. I think we normally leave that for a later stage in their education. And yet, I think that it is so important that it's there at the foundation. So questions about who is expert versus who is just kind of the story about are really fundamental to the kind of epistemological violence that happens through so much scholarly writing. And I think is also something that alienates a lot of students. And so they think, okay, well, I'm not interested in that. That's not, kind of an inclusive domain. And so I think that, you know, really talking with students about making sure that their own citational practices are what they should be is a great kind of, it's an eye-opening thing for undergraduate students and actually even for postgraduate students sometimes. They just haven't paid attention. Mm-hmm. And then also, it's just a useful kind of tool for us always to be using too. And so even though these are four different steps, so this kind of working through the scales and then informing the account and enriching the analysis and writing, obviously they're iterative, right? So once you've done it once through, then you get a case that is written to one level of depth. But then if you go through it again and again and again, then you can get a really rich set of stories. And indeed, that's one of my favorite things about teaching with case studies is that I'll often have students come back to me with a level of enrichment of analysis that I hadn't realized either. So, you know, that I think is what can be really rewarding is when you see, you know, that, okay, they're really generating something that feels like a fresh insight that gives me fresh purchase on mm-hmm. the situation that I'm trying to understand.
Well, it's a wonderful assignment and a wonderful book, very usable in a variety of contexts. This does bring us to our traditional final question, which is, what's next? What are you working on now?
Yeah, that is a big question. Look, this is another element of that pandemic impacts that I think, you know, right now I'm stuck in the small. I don't know if I hadn't turned in this book before the pandemic, I don't know how long it would have taken me to finish it because, you know, I feel like I've got so many exciting projects that are small right now. So including this Race and Biomedicine Beyond the Lab, interdisciplinary international project that I'm working on, some projects around racism and health and capacity building in that research area here in the UK where I live, smaller projects around pharmaceutical regulation and the ways that these reinforce social injustice, but nothing big, nothing big right now. That's feeling harder in this moment than it's felt for me in the first, 15 years, I guess, of my post PhD career. So I'm looking forward to kind of getting my feet under me a little bit, and welcoming inspiration for next larger projects.
That's where I am too. One little project at a time, one little step at a time, just sort of thinking small. It's good to know I'm not alone.
Absolutely. And I think, for me, I'm also very involved in editing. So I'm an editor at Catalyst Feminism Theory Technoscience, which is one journal, and then also at Biosocieties. And I do a ton of peer review of book manuscripts as well as of journal manuscripts as well. And for me, I actually really value that work too of, on one level, it's a smaller project, right? So kind of reviewing somebody else's work is a discrete thing, which I can tick off the to-do list. Mm-hmm. But it's also important, I think, for fostering the larger social and scholarly community that I want to be a part of. And I think that I really do have a faith and confidence that by really cultivating that and being part of that, I will be in good stead for the next larger thing down the line.
Well, wonderful. Well, big or small, I will look forward to your future work, Anne, and I want to thank you again for taking the time to come and share your work with us.
Thanks so much.